Sweet Shepherd by Franca Tolo is one of the hottest modern romances being read today. It's a digital book you can buy in all formats and read on any device for only $2.99 from Amazon.com. Sweet Shepherd is a classic tale of the ages about love and careers, legends and lifestyles, life and death. Order and read the new millennium's heat-warming novella, Sweet Shepherd by Franca Tolo. Get it now.
Catch the spirit on SRN1.
Hey, you. Yeah, you. You're missing out. What are you missing out on? Only the best way to spend your Wednesday nights. Tune in to SRN1 Wednesday nights for Hotspot Radio, playing all of your requests in dozens of unique and fun themes. Hosted by yours truly, DJ Thuban, and my husband, DJ Bolo, Hotspot Radio is a furry, theory, and otherkin-hosted show in its 10th season of broadcasting over the internet airwaves. So join us Wednesdays at 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Want to know more? Check out our website, hotspotradio.net, and be sure to tell your friends so they don't miss out, too. We'll see you there.
The following program is intended for mature audiences.
They used to bounce messages across the earth. Shows. Everyone in the old world had a show. Do you think there's still somebody out there? Sending shows? Who knows? Those are the planes of silence.
Good evening. This is Sal Manila with the Veritas News. Some are calling it Karma Fiorina. A few days after Ted Cruz announced Carly Fiorina as his pick for this vice presidential running mate, he and his entire family, who Fiorina had just introduced to the crowd at an Indiana rally, totally ignored Fiorina when she literally fell off the front of the stage in full view of hundreds of Cruz supporters, who also ignored her. What was noticed was Cruz's small audience of only hundreds, not thousands, which led not to the path of victory, but to the math of defeat. Ironically, 2 days ago, Cruz announced his withdrawal from the 2016 presidential campaign, and it is now he who has fallen off the stage to be rightfully ignored not by hundreds of us, but by millions. Cruz will return to his old job as obstructionist senator from Texas. Rumor has it that if he were to leave politics, he'd work on a book compilation of his most scathing insults titled Cruz Missiles. The penultimate Republican hopeful John Kasich announced yesterday that he, too, is dropping out of the race for the presidency. His departure leaves just one remaining candidate, the first orangutan to ever run for office, Donald Trump. Kasich, who is often mistaken by voters as a country western singer, says he may go with the flow and consider a recording contract offer from Nashville. His first album, titled If He Does, Go With the Flow. And this just in, a large joint class action suit has been filed in both New York and California against the Quaker Oats Company and its parent company, PepsiCo. Private testing labs have found dangerous levels of glyphosate, a weed killer deemed carcinogenic by the World Health Organization, and just recently proven by scientists internationally to definitely be cancer-causing. The independent labs have found these dangerous levels of glyphosate in exactly 100% of all Quaker Oats and Instant Quaker Oats tested. Both products, ironically, are labeled all natural. Glyphosate, a weed killer genetically engineered to kill everything but crops whose seeds are engineered not to die from glyphosate, is manufactured by the world's most hated corporation, Monsanto. The word Quaker, which means society of friends, is associated with purity and health. Since the Pepsi company took over, however, Quaker has been anything but pure and healthy. And now their company's society of friends includes not only Monsanto, but also many of the other corporados like Nestle, DuPont, Syngenta, Kellogg's, and even Pepsi's biggest competitor, Coca-Cola, all of whom have fought to prevent consumers from knowing if genetically modified organisms are in the food-like substances they sell. Glyphosate is the weed killer known as Roundup, the usual suspect. In another show that the Quaker values have been totally stripped from the cereal manufacturer, PepsiCo's stance toward the class action suit is anything but pacifistic and silent. Insiders have confirmed that they are doing all they can to sway the Environmental Protection Agency to raise the nation's legally allowable level of glyphosate. In response to the suit, a spokesman for PepsiCo said, quote, "Every generation refreshes the world," end quote. The EPA did, at least, warn residents of Flint, Michigan to avoid making and eating Quaker Oats, as the combination of the town's toxic water and the poison of glyphosate would result in not instant oats, but instant death. Stoners across America have expressed support toward the suit, hoping that a joint class action against any weed killer might prevent the unwanted killing of any of their weed. This has been Sal Manila with Savino Veritas News. Now here's Tom Savino with Savino Veritas.
Are you ready? Are you ready?
We're ready. We're ready. Yeah, we're ready. 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 We're ready. We're ready. Yeah, we're ready. 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 Ready.
We're ready for the road.
California, land of fantasy and make-believe. It's Savino Veritas. Featuring host, writer, humorist, experiential mystic, raconteur, and parallel parking expert, Tom Savino. Now, here he is with Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth, Tom Savino.
Good evening, everyone. Tom Savino here. Great to be back with you again after a trip to Utah. And tonight we are going to have a little surfing. Surf the web with me tonight on Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California, land of make-believe and fantasy, from Lion's Den Studios in Burbank. Lion's Den Studios. We are not soundproof. We're not foolproof. We are 100-proof. Join us and surf the web tonight.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf with dip-de-dip.
Well, first of all, happy Cinco de Mayo to everyone. Happy Cinco de Mayo. We know a famous person who gets all of his information from the internet, so maybe he'll be joining us tonight surfing and celebrating Cinco de Mayo, the very famous Donald Trump. I'm sure he is really celebrates Cinco de Mayo. He could use a few margaritas,
I think that could loosen him up a bit.
You don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead.
Oh, I will, Donald. I will. We're not through trying to get you out. We will get you out before you get in, believe me.
So tell me you love me. Please, 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 please. Tell me, tell me, tell me. Oh, tell me, tell me.
I must say I do love making fun of you, Donald, and will continue to do so up through November, when you fall off the face of the earth, hopefully, as did Ted Cruz this week. So you see, there are hopeful things. Now, ladies and gentlemen, this is Tom Savino from Burbank, California, Savino Veritas in Wine and the Truth, the fine wine of select gripes. And as you know, my biggest gripe, certainly today, is the official word that Donald Trump is the Republican nominee for the presidency. And we'll talk a lot more about that, and you'll be hearing a lot more about that as the months go on here on Savino Veritas and probably everywhere in the world that you have ears that you listen to. But I do want to say that I just got back from Utah, and boy, are my arms tired. No, I got back from Utah to visit my great-granddaughter, actually my daughter, my granddaughter and great-granddaughter, and it was a great trip, a wonderful trip. Actually mixed the bag, emotional scenes and joyful scenes. And it was an interesting trip indeed, but here I am now. And I just wanted, maybe you didn't know this, or maybe you don't care even, but the origin of the word Utah, the state name, Utah originates from an Apache Indian word, Utahe, Utahe, which means people of the mountains. Europeans thought the word referred to Indians living higher in the mountains than the Navajo, and the territory became known as the land of the Utes, 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 and eventually Utah. Utah comes from, this is another entry, we're surfing the web tonight, and that was one entry from State Symbols, statesymbolsusa.org. And this next one is from UEN.org, UEN.org. Utah comes from the Ute tribe and means people of the mountains. From Information Please, 1994 Almanac. Utah, from a Navajo word meaning upper or higher up, as applied to a Shoshone tribe called the Ute, and that's what Utah means. I don't know if the Navajo and Shoshone were amicable or feuding, but I do know the Sioux and the Shoshone were enemies. If the Sioux had a word for the Ute tribe, even if it meant upper or higher, I'm certain their attitude toward uttering it would be the same as mine for Republicans when we call Republicans the right. If anyone were more wrong than the right, there'd be no Americans around at all to talk about it. We'd be gone. We'd be devastated. Yes, dear Republicans, what is wrong with you? What is wrong with you? How did you choose this candidate for the presidency of the United States? We are a laughingstock of the world. Of course, you can change your ways. There's still time. It's only May the 5th, Cinco de Mayo. We got a lot of time between now and November. And everyone, I don't care what affiliation you are, what party you are, do not vote for this lunatic to be the president of the United States.
I wouldn't do that if I were you.
Well, my wife and I and my daughter, granddaughter, and great-granddaughter went to this little kiddie play area in the mall in Ogden, Utah. And my little great-granddaughter was playing with the other kids and frolicking, and we were watching him. And my daughter noticed a little boy, maybe 3, 4 years old, who came to the play area wearing a bomber's jacket. He was wearing a bomber's jacket. And with my great hearing, if you don't know, I have... I have the oral version. They say you are the oral version of Mr. Magoo. So I hear things that aren't there, in a sense. So my daughter said that this kid was wearing a bomber's jacket, and I thought she said he was wearing an Obama jacket. And then we joked about my hearing and laughed, and we both realized that an Obama jacket would be a straight jacket. That's what it would be a straight jacket, because that is what the Republicans have done for 8 years. They have obstructed every possible bit of good that we can do for the community at large, the entire nation as a whole. Obama has been placed in a straitjacket, and he's able to do very little. Even his presidential directives, executive orders, even they are fought in the Supreme Court and stopped by people who are thankfully in the ground right now, at least one of them. I don't know what hope we have here for this country, which brings me to one of the subjects we're going to cover today, and that is truth. The name of this show is Savino Veritas. Veritas means the truth. I aim for satire and jokes, of course, and that's what I hope to do, and I hope you're entertained by it, and I try to do that. But I do aim for the truth.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me. Now surf, surf with Bob, dip to dip to dip, Bob, dip to dip.
Here's a piece that gets to the heart of this matter of truth. Truth matters. Black lives matter. Truth matters. This is called Separation of Truth and State. Separation of Truth and State. It was on a website called Laissez-Faire. In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. That is from George Orwell. Who said that? George Orwell. In a time of universal deceit, telling the truth is a revolutionary act. George Orwell. If you tell a big lie, and this is a quotation from Joseph Goebbels. Joseph Goebbels, he said, quote, "If you tell a lie big enough and keep repeating it, people will eventually come to believe it." Okay. Do I need to tell you who's a good illustration of that? I don't need to. I don't need to tell you that.
You don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead.
The lie, Goebbels went on, can be maintained only for such time as the state, with a capital S, can shield the people from the political, economic, and or military consequences of the lie. It thus becomes vitally important for the state to use all of its powers to repress dissent, for the truth is the mortal enemy of the lie, and thus, by extension, the truth is the greatest enemy of the state, said Joseph Goebbels.
I said I- truth.
Goebbels is right. Truth is the greatest enemy of the state, which is why governments spend massive amounts of money and resources to suppress truth and spew disinformation to confuse the masses. Now, again, everybody, I'm reading this little piece. It's from Laissez-Faire. I'm going to comment on it as we go along, that paragraph. I just want to say that it's not just the government, okay? Which is why governments spend massive amounts of money and resources to suppress the truth. Corporations. And then that brings us to the question, is there a separation between government and corporations? I don't think there is now. I do believe the United States has totally become a plutocracy, and it is run by the corporations, and really no definitive, it's a gray area where the state and the corporations end. You know, Salmonella, which is satirical news, as you know. Salmonella started the show with a satirical news. But all of those stories are real stories that we just, Sal puts his little take on it for satirical reasons. But that story about Quaker Oats is true. There is a big class action lawsuit against the Quaker Oats Company and PepsiCo that has dangerously high levels of glyphosate in the Quaker Oats and the Quaker Instant Oats, the so-called all-natural oats. And they are, the corporations are trying to manipulate the EPA, that's government. So there is there's nothing clear. It's not, you know, it's the state and the corporations. And can you determine one from the other? I think not. This is what's going on here. Now I'm going to go back to reading the piece. The state spreads lies because it must. It must, in order to survive, kill the truth completely. It must separate the citizen's mind from reality. An obedient citizen will believe that up is down and left is right just because he is told it is so. The state needs obedient citizens. In order for the state to preserve itself, the masses must believe they are victims, incapable of taking care of themselves. They must believe that prosperity is evil and unrighteous and should be eradicated from civilized society. And they must believe that the truth is too complex and that only those picked by the state know what's best. If the masses fall for it, as they have, the truth begins to suffer. And if truth dies completely, so does, in equal measure, the individual's power, liberty, freedom, and oftentimes humanity. But of course, a lie is easier than the truth because the truth is dangerous. All throughout history, that has been the case. The truth has always been dangerous to those who speak it. Shining example of brave truth tellers, the White Rose, a resistance group in Nazi Germany, risked life and limb to spread the truth about what the Nazis were up to, and paid for it dearly. These wonderful young people, most in their teens and 20s, lived in Germany during the Hitler regime. That was said by Butler Schaefer, who wrote that on the Lou Rockwell blog, and then continues, quote, and spent much of their time writing and distributing leaflets, exposing and criticizing the policies and practices of the Nazi state. He goes on, this is still a quote from Butler Schaefer, quote, they were found out brought to trial, found guilty of treason, the demoralization of the troops, and abetting the enemy, and summarily beheaded. Sophie's Gestapo interrogator raises the same arguments one hears directed against such modern speakers of the truth as Chelsea Manning, Ed Snowden, Julian Assange, Glenn Greenwald, and others. The quotation from Schaefer continues, Those whose moral and intellectual standards can raise no higher than to whine, "The law is the law," would do well to consider the exchange between Sophie and her prosecutor. The Nazi functionary declares, quote, "Without law, there is no order. What can we rely on if not the law?" Sophie responds, quote, "Your conscience. Laws change. Conscience doesn't," end quote. The Western world, as you know, is collapsing under our feet, and the truth about what's really going on as a result is becoming harder and harder to unearth. This is a continuing quotation from Schaefer. This is from his blog. "Our institutionalized world," he says, "is increasingly hostile to any utterances of truth that would be upsetting to the status quo. The mainstream media and most of academia long ago gave themselves over to propagandizing on behalf of defending and or enhancing the coercive power structure of the state," end quote. Why aren't more people, quote, awake to the truth in our age of information? Well, to most, the truth is frightening. So they ignore it. You cannot control the truth. It is final, like death. And that's what makes it terrifying. Once you know it, there's no going back. Also, we are social creatures, so our natural tendency is to fall in line. We don't want to rattle in any cages because in our past, that often meant death. Unfortunately, this herd mentality makes us easy to manipulate. We are told and want to believe that a hero is just around the corner. Think of anyone in particular, friends? Here to fix all of our ills. Very few people, though, are willing to recognize the truth. The ship is going down, and life will never be the same when it does. This is my commentary here, because that part reminds me of the frog in the pot. Of water analogy. I think you've all heard this. If not, here it is. A frog will not jump out of hot water if he's in the water when it's cool and as it gradually heats up to boiling. It doesn't recognize it. Yes, a frog will stay away from hot water if he's not in it, but if he's in water that it's at a regular temperature and that water is raised slowly to boiling, he won't be aware that he is boiling in that water himself. I think we're very much like that. We're very much like that. The environmental catastrophe we've created that we've known for many decades is happening. That's an example, I think, of the frog in the water analogy. And also of that last paragraph from the piece I was reading, where the ship is going down and life will never be the same when it does. I'm going to continue on this piece today to talk about what happens in societies when the truth begins to falter. We've invented Jeff Thomas of International Man to the show. Thomas is going to rap about the first casualty of war, why most Americans live in fantasy land, and why they keep from turning into a truthless zombie. The first casualty is truth by Jeff Thomas. That's what I'm going to read right now, everybody. In the 5th century BC, Greek dramatist Aeschylus said, quote, "In war, truth is the first casualty," end quote. Quite so. Whenever national leaders decide to go on the war path for the sake of their own ambition or self-aggrandizement, it's the citizenry that will pay the bloody price for its aspirations. Since war is rarely desired by the citizenry, it has to be sold to them. Some form of deception, exaggeration, or outright lies must be put forward to con the populace into getting on board with the idea. War, after all, represents a monumental failure of national leaders to serve the rightful national objectives of a citizenry, peace and prosperity. Of course, in the case of an empire going to war, this represents a monumental failure on steroids. The outcome may well be world war in such a case. Readers of this publication will no doubt be well versed in the knowledge that when an empire is nearing the end of its period of domination, war is almost always used by leaders as a last-ditch attempt to maintain order. During wartime, a populace tends to focus more on the war than the failure of its leaders. In addition, they're likely to tolerate the removal of freedoms by their leaders to be, quote, patriotic. This being the case, we might surmise that an empire in decline would be likely to display similar symptoms to a country at war. One of those symptoms might well be the loss of truth, not just as it relates to warfare, but as it relates to the society as a whole. A nation in decline might even welcome the disappearance of truth, as it would allow the people to continue to feel good about themselves at a time when a truthful outlook would be too unpleasant to be tolerated. Further, the closer to collapse the country may be, economically, politically, and socially, the more extreme the self-created loss of truth would likely be. Let's have a look at a few cultural examples and see if that premise seems viable. Silver versus chocolate. As I described in January in Running Out of Candy, Californian Mark Dice stood on a sweet corner offering passers-by either a free 10-ounce bar of silver or a free bar of Hershey's chocolate. Without fail, each one chose the chocolate, even though Mr. Dice was standing in front of a coin shop where the silver bar could be redeemed. They rejected the silver, which they knew had to have greater value. Only 20 years ago, people would have been far less likely to deny truth in favor of a falsehood that was more palatable. The instant gratification of candy. In effect, this is the abandonment of basic truth in favor of whatever perception is more pleasant. Kim Jong-un on, quote, Dancing with the Stars, end quote. Talk show host Jimmy Kimmel recently asked people on the street if they had seen Korean leader Kim Jong-un on the popular television show Dancing with the Stars. Clearly, they had not, as the idea was absurd. Yet many answered, yes. then went on to describe their appraisal of his performance as though they had seen it. Some went into depth, expounding on the artistry and social value of the non-existent performance. The interviewer went on to remind the interviewees that Kim Jong-un is in fact a dictator, and asked whether they thought it was a good taste for him to have pointed a machine gun at the audience. In spite of the now blatant absurdity, interviewees continued to pretend they had actually witnessed in performance, offering their opinion on how well he had performed. They responded in accordance with what appeared to be expected of them, rather than choose the less pleasant option of saying, "I'm sorry, but I didn't see it." Now, the video was clearly offered by Jimmy Kimmel to show his audience how dumb people can be, but it demonstrates something more. It shows us that a significant segment of the population is quite prepared to simply abandon reality by first pretending to have witnessed something they have not, and second, offering firm and even complex opinions on something that did not occur. Political candidacy. Certainly, political hopefuls have always had a reputation for being less than truthful, and any responsible voter would be advised to look at every candidate with a jaundiced eye. But what if voters chose to lie to themselves in order to validate candidates? Back when the United States became the unquestioned empire in the world, just after the World War II, Americans took a great deal of pride in truth and honor. A candidate might be suspected of personal immoral behavior and/or corruption and still be elected, but if it were blatant, he would not. Today, the liberal media regularly refer to the record of presidential candidate Donald Trump, highlighting the companies that have gone bust and people who have been financially ruined as a result of his dealings. They also highlight his ever-changing political viewpoints, arrogance, and disdain for virtually everyone but himself. Yet, supporters of Mr. Trump virtually block out the repeated reports, focusing only on their enjoyment of his bombast toward the establishment. And the conservative media have been equally persistent in calling attention to candidate Hillary Clinton's long history of shady business dealings, her failure to regard to the Benghazi incident, her selling of influence whilst acting officially as a Secretary of State, her acceptance of large campaign donations from the Wall Street, and most prominently, her very possibly illegal abuse of top secret government documents. Yet half of all Democrats at present are content to simply treat all that evidence as though it has no significance. To put this in perspective, as recently as 1974, the American public were so outraged over their presidents having complied with a cover-up of an information burglary that he was forced to resign his office. Today, however, we observe that a sitting president, but candidates for president, each of whom, regardless of their glaring instability, is able to attract a major portion of the public support and continue to campaign. Here, we need to focus on the shortcomings of the candidates, no matter how unfit for office they may be. but on the voters who choose to disregard the obvious truth. Again, abandonment of basic truth in favor of whatever perception is more pleasant. All of the above, I believe, are symptoms of a greater problem. As a Briton, I am very aware that during the decline of the British Empire, many of my fellow Brits pretended that it wasn't happening, saying, quote, "There will always be a Britain," end quote, "and the sun will never set on the British Empire," end quote, and telling they continued to behave as though Britain was top doggy in their neighborhood. We still had vestiges of this right up until the 1980s decades, after it was clearly all over. The United States, in its own decline, is showing this same self-destructive tendency. The worse things get, the greater the inclination of the citizenry to say, quote, "Carry on, everything is fine," end quote. When a ship is going down, the very worst reaction is to pretend that everything's fine, and that it will all turn out okay. Yet, just as it occurred in Britain, we see today in the American people a desire to pretend that, although all is not well, there's a rainbow just over the next rise, and that if the people and their presidential candidates will only make their hopes and promises big enough, the greatness will return along with good times for all. I wish that were the case, but I am inclined to believe that the self-deception does not improve the situation. It exacerbates it. Better to face reality than create a plan to address the reality. And that was from Jeff Thomas, the editor of International Man. You're listening to Savino Veritas in Wine and the Truth. The whole truth, nothing but the truth. So help us. And you can help us by writing to us at tjsavino22@gmail.com. tjsavino22@gmail.com. You may also send me a tweet. Follow me on Twitter, please. I'll follow you back at TJ Savino Twitter. TJ Savino Twitter. And if you want to write at length, it's tjsavino22@gmail.com. This next little piece is from Bernie Sanders, who sent me an email, along with thousands, maybe millions of other people. So I'm not saying he sent it to me personally, but he did send this and said, "Tom," that's me, "Tom, I want to share something with you that is probably going to make you angry. But then I'm going to give you an opportunity to do something about it. For months, you've heard the Clinton campaign endlessly repeat in interviews and on social media that they have raised millions and millions of dollars for state parties through something called the Hillary Victory Fund. They've even used it as an attack line to insinuate Bernie wasn't willing to help down ballot Democrats. Well, yesterday morning, thanks to a Politico investigation, we found out that less than 1% of the $61 million raised by the Victory Fund has stayed in state party coffers. And indeed, the majority of the money spent by the Victory Fund has gone to benefit Hillary Clinton's primary campaign against us. The piece said some state party fundraisers believe they are basically acting as, quote, money laundering conduits, end quote. There's more, but first let me get to the part where you can take action. In recent weeks, the Clinton campaign has expressed a lot of interest in what is important to Bernie's supporters. Here's your chance to send a message about your distaste for big money in politics. Sign our petition calling on the Clinton campaign to stop bending campaign finance rules to their breaking point and immediately transfer all the money allowable to the state parties participating in the Hillary Victory Fund. Here's how the scheme works for the Clinton campaign. Rich people like Alice Walton of Walmart, who have already contributed the maximum amount allowable to the Clinton campaign, can contribute an additional $350,000 plus to the Victory Fund. The first $33,400 of her contribution is supposed to go to the Democratic National Convention Fund, and the rest divided up between participating state parties. But that's not what's been happening. The Victory Fund has mostly been doing one of two things with Miss Walton's money. One, taking the money and spending it on advertisements and small dollar fundraising solicitations. Then they take all the small dollar contributions and data reaped from Alice Walton's contribution and transfer it directly to the Clinton campaign. This tactic is basically a way for them to benefit from a contribution much larger than the legal limit from Alice Walton. Two, they take Alice Walton's money and transfer it to state parties, who then immediately transfer it to the DNC. Oftentimes, they do it without the state party even knowing, because the Clinton campaign controls many of the bank accounts involved. So at the end of the day, most of the state parties have received exactly zero from their Victory Fund arrangement. So now that we know the Clinton campaign is taking advantage of state parties to skirt fundraising limits on her presidential campaign, it's time for her to do the right thing and let the state parties keep their fair share of the cash. Sign our petition calling on the Clinton campaign to stop bending campaign finance rules to their breaking point and immediately transfer all the money allowable to the state parties participating in the Hillary Victory Fund. It's unfortunate that Hillary Clinton has benefited from tens of millions of dollars in cash transfers and advertising to campaign against us in the primary. But it's not too late for her campaign to do the right thing by the state parties. We're going to need to win elections up and down the ticket this November. I'm sure if you sign our petition, that is something they will notice in solidarity. That was actually written by Jeff Weaver, the campaign manager of the Bernie Sanders 2016 campaign. Thank you.
the Fabulous D Show.
I'm all tied up, ready. No.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards.
JuiceTalk.com.
Veritas is satire spelled backwards. With a V for victory.
Savino Veritas in Wine the Truth. This is Artist D.
And Anne Marie from Up All Night on For Culture Radio.
Have you got any wine, Anne Marie?
I'm completely intoxicated.
We love to wine. We drink wine. We listen to Savino Veritas every week at JuiceTalk.com. Don't we love Tom?
Hi, Tom.
Hi, Tom.
How you doing?
Should I go to college or not?
What's the best way to advertise my business?
Mo, Tibetan divination. Through an exclusive arrangement with Orgen Yeshe, Tibetan divination expert of the Buddhist Rime Order, Savino Veritas listeners can get their tough questions answered through the universal synchronicity of Manjushri's consciousness, seer of all, past, present, and future. Orgen Yeshe reads your question and rolls the blessed red dice for you. In his deep, mantra-induced meditative trance, Orgen Yeshe internalizes your question, throws the sacred dice, and based on Manjushri's guidance, which Yeshe will invoke for you, captures the emergence of your answer. The price? Contribute what you can at $5 or more. Deposit your offering to the PayPal account of tjsavino22@gmail.com. Again, deposit $5 or what you can to the PayPal account of tjsavino22@gmail.com. Write a well-thought-out question and send it to tjsavino22@gmail.com along with your self-selected $5 or more contribution to the PayPal account of tjsavino22@gmail.com. Savino Veritas will dispatch your answer via email within 3 days of submission. Mo, Tibetan Divination.
Can I trust my boyfriend to be faithful?
What's the best month for the wedding, May or June?
Will I ever get pregnant?
Who's the best candidate to fill the supervisor's job? May I count on my best pitcher to win this game?
How much should I gamble at the casino?
Do I need to go see the doctor about this condition?
Is Atlanta the right place for me to move?
Should we increase our homeowner's insurance?
If I get the job, will it help our relationship?
Will marital therapy keep us together?
Where should I look for my lost ring?
Will I ever find it? Can I? Should he?
Should he?
Will they? When will?
Can?
Questions.
Questions.
Money.
Love.
Renies.
Mo.
Mo, Tibetan Divination. Send a well-thought-out question to tjsavino22@gmail.com. tjsavino22@gmail.com. Deposit what you will in the PayPal account to tjsavino22@gmail.com. And Orgen Yeshe, the Tibetan divination expert, will send you the answer to that question in a short time, about 4 days. tjsavino22@gmail.com.
Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California.
Leaders that don't know what they're doing.
Like yourself?
He throws tantrums about stupid things.
You don't even know what you're talking about. Try getting it out. Go ahead. Tremendous potential.
He's like, you're awful. Vote for me.
If you want to be a president, you shouldn't be racist.
I get you're speaking your mind, but say it in a way that won't hurt people.
There are Muslims in the world who, you know, hate what's happening. To just, like, ban all of them would be extreme.
If he's gonna be rude to ladies, he shouldn't be a president.
Can he not win, please?
Is there no one else? Is there no one else?
You're listening to Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California, from Lion's Den Studios. And I'm Tom Savino. That's me. I'm here every Thursday night, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Eastern time, and all the other international times in between. I have here a letter that was written by Elizabeth Warren to the general public about Donald Trump. And here it is. Let's be honest, Donald Trump is a loser. Count all his failed businesses. See how he kept his father's empire afloat by cheating people with scams like Trump University and by using strategic corporate bankruptcies to skip out on debt. Listen to the experts who've concluded he's so bad at business that he might have more money today if he'd put his entire inheritance into an index fund and just left it alone. Trump seems to know he's a loser. His embarrassing insecurities are on parade. Petty bullying, attacks on women, cheap racism, and flagrant narcissism. But just because Trump is a loser everywhere else doesn't mean he'll lose this election. People have been underestimating his campaign for nearly a year, and it's time to wake up. People talk about how, quote, this is the most important election, end quote, in our lifetime every 4 years, and it gets stale. But consider what hangs in the balance. Affordable college, accountability for Wall Street, health care for millions of Americans, the Supreme Court, big corporations and billionaires paying their fair share of taxes, expanding Social Security, investments in the infrastructure and medical research and jobs right here in America. The chance to turn on our back on the ugliness of hatred, sexism, racism, and xenophobia. The chance to be a better people. More than anyone we've seen before come within reach of the presidency, Donald Trump stands ready to tear apart an America that was built on values like decency, community, and concern for our neighbors. Many of history's worst authoritarians started out as losers, and Trump is a serious threat. The way I see it, it's our job to make sure he ends this campaign every bit the loser that he started it. Elizabeth Warren. Happy Cinco de Mayo, everyone. And you could hear them doing the Mexican hat dance, or as I call it, the Donald Stomp. The Donald Stomp. Do the Donald Stomp on his head, and you can enjoy Cinco de Mayo without the racist. Thank you.
Surfing is the only life, the only way for me now. Surf, surf.
So this is Tom Savino with Savino Veritas, live from Burbank, California. And one thing I found surfing the web this week was something from Esquire magazine. The 75 movies every man should see. The 75 movies every man should see. Now, we're going to go through this list or as much as we can before the end of the show. And it is not ranked. It's an incomplete list, they say. It's utterly biased of what they think is the greatest films that have shaped American men. And how many have you watched? Well, let's go over it here. The first they have on their list, and again, this is not a this is not in order of hierarchy. This is not an order of this is the best or this. They're just a list of 74. And one is In the Heat of the Night. In the Heat of the Night. That's the 1967 film, In the Heat of the Night, starring Sidney Poitier, Rod Steiger, and Warren Oates. And the reason they give, the Esquire magazine, says, never has a man been in a more wrong place at a wrong time. The next on the list is Slapshot. Slapshot, Mr. Paul Newman on skates, on ice, covered in blood. I find the reasoning troublesome to me. I think it is sexist. Does the man need to see a movie that has a lot of blood in it? Is that like a male thing? It isn't for me. I don't particularly like to see a lot of blood and gore and violence, but I guess the people who made this list feel that men should enjoy watching Paul Newman covered in blood. I wouldn't. I didn't see Slapshot, but I certainly think Paul Newman was a very good actor. Another on the list is Iron Man. He's just a man doing his best with the superpowered robotic heart that the good Lord gave him. And next is Jaws. Jaws. The shark was a giant malfunctioning puppet with fake teeth. And it's still scared every loving shit out of me, it says here. And it did for me, too. The original Jaws did for me. I still remember that. And I guess in some way it has shaped me as an American male somehow. Any literature that affects you, whether it's film or books, could certainly shape who you are. Oh, now here's a good one. And I think Save the Tiger, 1973. The nominees for Best Actor in 1973, Marlon Brando, Jack Nicholson, Robert Redford, Al Pacino, and Jack Lemmon. And the Oscar goes to Jack Lemmon. I think Save the Tiger is an excellent film. And an excellent story. And Jack Lemmon deserved the Oscar for 1973, in my opinion. 12 Angry Men. Once again, speaking of great literature, 12 Angry Men, I think, is in that category. And I think that Esquire putting it on the list is accurate. It just shaped me as an American male. It was a film that I saw later on. It came out in 1957. I was only 7 when it came out, so it didn't shape anything for me then. But later, it certainly did when I saw it in high school. And as a high school teacher, I've played 12 Angry Men, and we've read the script, studied the play, 12 Angry Men. And again, that was starring starring Henry Fonda, Lee J. Cobb, Martin Balsam. When I first moved to Los Angeles, I was in line to buy a slice of pizza in Brentwood, California, and standing right in front of me was Henry Fonda waiting for his pizza, and I knew I had arrived in Hollywood. I knew it. It was, this movie, by the way, was directed by Sidney Lumet, who I admire. I think he's done some very good work. Back to the list. 12 Angry Men. The next one on the list, Fast Times at Ridgemont High. The Dow of Spicoli. I have to admit, I never saw this movie, so I don't know. It didn't shape anything about me, but maybe it did about you. If it did, let us know. Please respond. Write to me at tjsavino22@gmail.com. Let me know if Fast Times at Ridgemont High shaped you as an American male. We're reading the list from Esquire magazine, the 75 films that every man should see or should have seen, and movies they say shaped American men. Number 8, and again, this is not in order of best or anything, just 74, Chinatown. Yes, Chinatown. Oh, yes, Chinatown. Best written, best cast, best acted, most confusing, beautiful, sad, funny, tragic movie about the city most evocative of the American myth. Chinatown.
I said I want the truth.
She's my sister. She's my daughter. My sister, my daughter.
I said I want the truth. No!
When you're slapped, you'll take it and like it.
While there are Bogart films on this list, he wasn't in Chinatown. Jack Nicholson and Faye Dunaway. 1974. That was a good one. 1974. I was 24. And I found Faye Dunaway very, very sexy, especially in Bonnie and Clyde. I don't think Bonnie and Clyde's on this Esquire list. Let's go back to the Esquire list, because we're surfing here on Surfing the Web with Tom Savino and Savino Veritas.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
Of course, that was Marlon Brando in The Godfather. And boy, did that shape me as a male. It had a lot to do with my identity, being an Italian-American, and so on and so forth. I related to it a lot. And it had a lot to do with shaping me as a male, I think. Anyway, that's The Godfather. The next on the list is Fitzcarraldo. Fitzcarraldo, because we've all had to carry a ship over a mountain once in our lives. Fitzcarraldo. Ghostbusters. Man at elevator. What are you supposed to be? Some kind of cosmonaut? Dr. Venkman. No, we're exterminators. Somebody saw a cockroach up on 12. Anyway, that was from Ghostbusters. Glory, if only for the final scene, which turns Matthew Broderick, into not just the man, but a hero. Wall Street, father-son issues, Hal Holbrook as the blind seer, and a case for greed that's so bad it's good. I don't know if that shaped me as a male, but I'm glad I saw it, and it was a pivotal movie, I think, for many Americans, for American cinema. We're going over the list of 74 movies that Esquire feels every American male should have seen or should see if haven't. Wall Street. The next one is Runaway Train. Runaway Train. Existential action flicks are tough tricks to pull. Turns out the secret is two escaped cons and a girl on the runaway train in Alaska, chased by an evil warden in a helicopter. Easy. Now, this is interesting, Runaway Train. Now, I did see Runaway Train. I think it is an excellent film. And it reminds me that I think I need to see it again. It's about time I've seen Runaway Train again. Runaway Train, let's see on this here. Runaway Train, Runaway. I'm typing, as you can hear. Runaway Train. I'm surfing the web, and that's what we're doing here on Savino Veritas. Runaway Train. Don't be confused. Don't confuse it with Runaway Bride. Runaway Train was 1985, and it stars, of course, John Voight, Eric Roberts. Now, the interesting thing on the image they have on Esquire magazine, which I guess is it's an MGM DVD cover, has John Voight and Eric Roberts. Now, Eric Roberts on this DVD cover with wearing this winter hat. he looks like the actress from Fargo, Frances McDormand. Another film on the Esquire list for men. Rosemary's Baby. Now, I loved Rosemary's Baby. I thought it was great. I enjoyed it. It was a memorable film. Why that's a movie on the list that shapes American men, I don't know. It says here, though, this is when you learn that there are bad people in the world. Rosemary's Baby. North by Northwest, with Cary Grant. North by Northwest, the first Bond movie, it says here. I don't know what they mean by that. Is maybe that kind of adventurous style that is in most Bond movies. I guess that's a comment they're making. The first Bond movie, North by Northwest. Lone Star. I did not see Lone Star. I tend to avoid Texas things myself. But Lone Star, for the Killer Blues and Tejano soundtrack, for the shot panning across a bar and across a generation. Now, that description intrigues me. I think I'd like to see a camera shot panning across a bar and across a generation. And for Matthew McConaughey, who acted well, it says here. I'm kind of interested. Maybe I will look up Lone Star and check it out. ...1966... with, of course, Clint Eastwood. Now, he looks here, a very slender figure in the poster they have here on Esquire. Spaghetti Western. And this is Clint Eastwood in his more cognitive days, before he started talking to empty chairs. I think it's worth it just for the theme. I love it. Ennio Morricone wrote the theme. The good, the bad, the ugly.
You're not much of a bargain, you know. You're conceited and thoughtless and messy.
Next on the list is a Gene Hackman film. I can't think of a Gene Hackman film I don't like. There must be some, but when I think of Gene Hackman, I think of a good movie. This next one is a Gene Hackman film called The Conversation from 1974. The Conversation. Next is The Thin Blue Lion. Not Lion. Lion. The Thin Blue Lion. 1988. A film that successfully argued that a man was wrongfully convicted for murder by a corrupt justice system in Dallas County, Texas. So I guess it was more of a documentary, I guess, because that's, you know, it's not surprising that would happen in Texas. The next on Esquire's list that men should see is Johnny Dangerously. And it says, quote, "You farking sneaky bastard." I've never seen Johnny Dangerously, so I can't tell you much about it, but let's see. I'm going to type, excuse me for these little thumps on the international airwaves here, but Johnny, oh, what comes up? Johnny Depp, but Johnny Dangerous, Johnny, can I spell Dangerously? Johnny Dangerously. I'm not finding Johnny Dangerously. Am I spelling it wrong? Here it is, 1984, Johnny Dangerously, set in the 1930s, an honest, good-hearted man is forced to turn to a life of crime to finance his neurotic mother's skyrocketing medical bills. Johnny Dangerously, starring Harry Colomby, Jeff Harris, and directed by Amy Heckerling? A woman? A woman directed this?
How you doing?
Gene Hackman appears again. This is my favorite Gene Hackman film, The French Connection. The French Connection, which was in 1971. I was 21 years old, The French Connection. Before I came to California, I worked at a public relations firm in Manhattan, and a woman who worked there as well was an actress who was in this film. She had a very pivotal image in this film, and I wish I remember her name. I know Frank Attolo, I'm sure, remembers her name. Frank Attolo, if you're listening, please let us know. Frank Attolo of Cotolo Chronicles, which is heard every Thursday evening before my show. And the woman, whose name I don't remember, had this two or three seconds in the film, maybe not even three, maybe 2 seconds at best, where she is the mother of a child in a carriage that she is strolling in Manhattan and is just about hit and killed with the baby by an errant vehicle. And that's a couple of seconds in movie history that is memorable. Except I don't remember her name. I think Susan was her name, but I don't remember anything else about that. Frank Attolo will have to fill us in on that. Next on the list from Esquire is Miller's Crossing. Some people will argue this gangster twist isn't even the best Coen Brothers movie, but those people need to get hit in the face with a shovel like Dane did. Miller's Crossing, I must confess I didn't see it. came out in 1990, Miller's Crossing, and it stars Gabriel Byrne. And it's a Joel Cohn and Ethan Cohn film. They directed it and wrote it. I must see this film. And the next on the Esquire list is The Great Escape. Now, The Great Escape, this movie created in the 60s. Why? Because it's not about the Nazis. It's about the man, The Great Escape. Now, this movie, of course, stars Steve McQueen. And I have right here at hand an outtake of the Savino Veritas Oscar special with Zane Delgado and Jeremy Long and myself. And here is why I'm playing the outtake. This The Great Escape starred Steve McQueen, but listen to this outtake.
I'm not even familiar with him. Oh, he was really good in Shame.
Shame, Hunger. Pretty much every Steve McQueen movie he was fantastic in. And I...
Steve McQueen movies? Is he that old?
Steve McQueen? No. There's two Steve McQueens now. There's two Steve McQueens.
There's a new Steve McQueen?
There's a director.
Oh, the director Steve McQueen.
The director Steve McQueen is the new Steve McQueen, and the actor Steve McQueen is the old Steve.
I was going to say, wait a minute, Michael, he's not that
old. This is not the Great Train Robbery.
Not that old.
Well, Zane and Jeremy, certainly the joke was on me, and that's fine. The joke's on me, friends. Yes, Steve McQueen, they mentioned Steve McQueen. They just said Michael Fassbender was in so many Steve McQueen movies. And I thought, Michael Fassbender is not that old. I'm not familiar with the Steve McQueen director. I need to brush up on my film knowledge, especially before the next Oscar special in February. Next on the Esquire list is Dawn of the Dead. Next is Shaun of the Dead, the best zombie movie ever made about friendship. Oh, I saw this movie. I did see this, and it's that funny British guy. That funny, you know, let me give him credit. Shaun of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead, here it is, and it's 2004, starring Simon Pegg, and it is funny. I think it's very good. You'll enjoy it. Next is Hate, three kids from the projects falling into the urban abyss, scraping frantically at the air, trying not to hit the pavement. Okay, I have never seen Hate. First Blood with Sylvester Stallone. First half, a great chase. Second half, a thorough revenge. Okay, sounds like a movie. First Blood. Bottle Rocket. Now, I was reading about this because I had never heard of Bottle Rocket, but it is quite an interesting movie. A simple story about the need for careful planning. Happens to be Wes Anderson's best movie and Owen Wilson's, too. Bottle Rocket. Bad Day at Black Rock. Now, this is a movie, friends. Bad Day at Black Rock. Spencer Tracy, Lee Marvin, 1955, I think it is, 1955, yes, 1955, I totally recommend it. Next movie is Tootsie, yes, it was definitely a movie that helped shape me and my views of sexism against women. Tootsie, because no movie about the impossibility of love has ever been as funny, and because of young Jessica Lange and young Gina Davis in their underwear. I would agree with that comment by Esquire. Broadcast News, because dialogue has never been better since movies added sound.
that was written by James Lowe, I think his name is, who wrote some sitcoms, but he's a very good dialogue writer. He's a good screenwriter. Next is The Terminator. It just says, enough said. So let's not say any more. Shakes the Clown. Now, this is an interesting thing, ladies and gentlemen. Shakes the Clown. I've never heard of this, but in researching this, I must watch it now. Came out in 1991. And listen, I'm going to read you a couple of quotations of the dialogue from Shakes the Clown. Judy says, "Leave me alone, milkman scum." A female clown barfly says, "I got one of them peanut butter pussies. It's brown, smooth, and easy to spread." This is my kind of movie. The first party dad at a gathering where clowns are. First party dad says, "Are you the clown?" Shakes the Clown says, "No, I'm Mary fucking Poppins." Oh, this is good. I got to see this. Shakes the Clown says, hey, kid, what are you doing?" Kid, "I had to go to the bathroom." Shakes the Clown, "On my head?" Kid, "Hey, this is my bathroom, not your bedroom, you big drunken mess." Dink says, "I asked her what time it was. She told me it was 7:30. Stenchy says, "Oh, that's the cornerstone of a lasting relationship. What time it is?" Dink, yes, because first I asked her what time it is, right? Tomorrow I get to ask her the date, and the day after that, she's all over me. That's how it works. You play it slow. Owen, cheese, you clowns are on dope. Binky the Clown, you didn't see nothing, old man. We're just five happy party clowns sitting down to a plate of beef. White, powdery beef. Shakes the Clown says to mimes, "You silent motherfuckers." I have to watch this movie. Ho ho, the clown says, "Oh yeah? Well, the only show you could ever star in would be a show called The Not Funny Diarrhea Club." And again, the female clown barfly says, "As soon as that camera's off, he gonna fuck that little dog."
Go ahead. Make my day.
Dirty Harry. Straw Dogs. Raging Bull. Of course, Citizen Kane.
Here's Johnny.
The Shining.
I'm gonna be the mother of your child. I want a little respect.
Fatal Attraction. It really made me think twice about having affairs again after that. Well, I'm sorry we didn't get to all 74 films on the Esquire list of films that shaped men's attitudes. This is Tom Savino with Savino Veritas. Be with us again next Thursday and every Thursday at 11 p.m. Eastern Time, 8 p.m. Pacific Time, and 24/7 on a Too Cool for School website, juicedtalk.com. Take care, everybody.
Meeting is adjourned. Oh, I am sorry, sir. I didn't mean to overstep my bounds. You say that.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
No, you say that, Governor.
What?
Meeting is adjourned.
It is?
The end.
By George, he's got it. It is the end.
No, that'll be all. Just be sure to lock the door behind you on your way out. Good night.